Good morning, everyone. Our topic this morning is the two wings of the bird. This is an illustration that we find used in lots of different traditions, and the talk this morning will be based on Swamiji's use of it, but he also uses it in different senses. Sometimes he'll talk about this need for society's need for the uplift of women, because the society can't run if just the men are well off and have privileges and everything, that women also need their equal rights and everything. But he uses it in the second sense, which we find in Bhakti Yoga, which I want to talk about today, where he's talking about this harmony between knowledge and devotion. So that will be the essence of the talk this morning. We read in Bhakti Yoga where Swamiji says, three things are necessary for a bird to fly: the two wings and a tail as a rudder for steering. Jnana, knowledge, is the one wing. Bhakti, or love, is the other. And yoga, meditation, is the tail that keeps up the balance. It's a very beautiful illustration. Even the idea of a bird, we find this is used extensively in Vedanta. So many of Sri Ramakrishna's own examples are thinking of the soul itself as a bird, and that gets free from its cage, it can fly through the air. Here we have this wonderful illustration of a bird. If it only has one wing, it can't do anything. It needs both wings to be able to fly, and then even to steer and everything, it needs the tail as a kind of rudder. So we have that illustration. There's so many other illustrations with the bird that sits on the mast of the ship, and the two birds that are on the same tree. Even when Sri Ramakrishna talks about the different types of samadhi that he would have, I think he quotes the one sadhu from Rishikesh that says there are five different types. One is where the tree is hopping from one branch to another until it gets to the very top of the tree. So we find this idea of the bird and this idea of flying and soaring, that idea of freedom, is always associated with the soul in that state of freedom. And some of us, I don't get it very often, but occasionally you have flying dreams. How many people have had dreams where you fly? Yeah, to me, this is that desire of the soul to be free from the body that we experience in the dream state sometimes. And we feel that freedom that we feel flying in the dream is that freedom that we want in this waking state, when we realize that this self is like a bird, not confined to the cage of this body. Even Sri Ramakrishna's first experience of samadhi had to do with his vision of a bird. He was just a young boy, probably 6 or 7 years old at the time. You know the story. He was walking through the field, open field, and it was the rainy season. Sometimes in the rainy season, all of a sudden, the sky will get black. This big dark rain cloud will form. So very quickly it formed in the sky, and there was a beautiful white crane that was flying, and he saw that contrast between this dark background of the rain cloud and this beautiful white crane. And his mind started to soar, and he went into some state that we can't really describe, and he lost all outer consciousness of the world, fell to the ground. It looked to others like he had simply fainted, and he was found later by the villagers, and they carried him home. But he explained it, described it as a feeling of indescribable joy. We don't get much of an explanation what went through his mind. We know what triggered it, partly just the beauty of that scene, but also I think partly this idea of this freedom of the bird soaring that gave him the feeling of the freedom of the self within. So we find this illustration of the bird, very common, the bird flying in that state of great freedom, that state of great joy. But the special feature of Swamiji's statement is this idea that the two wings represent the two different spiritual paths. And the reason why it's so remarkable is that there's a very long tradition in Vedanta and in the whole spiritual history of India of looking upon these as two separate paths, Bhakti Marga and Jnana Marga, that there are different people who were suited to one and some were suited to the other. Sri Ramakrishna gives so many examples. He talks about those born with an element of Vishnu that will be more suited to the path of devotion, those born with an element of Shiva, they'll lean towards the path of knowledge. So we're used to this, this idea that it's a question of temperament, we choose one or the other. When we read the different scriptures, we read these Narada Bhakti Sutras, and even this idea that they can be combined, a little bit of knowledge will be helpful in the path to devotion. Narada says, well, maybe, but really the highest understanding is pure devotion, Shuddha Bhakti, which Ramakrishna also talks about. So a little bit of fanaticism that way. On the other side, the path of knowledge, also a little bit of fanaticism. This Shankaracharya's idea that nothing but knowledge can destroy ignorance. No matter what we say about the other paths, they'll all be secondary and subsidiary. Ultimately, it'll only be knowledge. So we're a little bit used to this clinging to one or the other by the proponents of each. And this idea that it's a question of adhikara. It's a question of ruchi and adhikara, what our particular taste is and what we're suited for. So different people have different worldviews, which will take them towards this path of knowledge, and some which will take them towards the path of devotion. Now, we find also different personality types, that some are simply intellectual. The devotee will say they're dry, right? A little dry intellectual types, they like to look upon God as impersonal absolute, as the supreme Brahman, and their goal is to realize their absolute oneness that way. Then the devotees, they'll be more emotional, and of course the jnanis will say a little bit illogical or irrational. They'll like to think of God in a very personal way, and if you ask them to give some rational explanation, they'll say, well, it's not necessary. You're missing the whole point of that. But they want to look upon God in a personal way as a loving father, a loving mother, have some type of relationship, and in such a way that they can achieve a state of union, not necessarily oneness, a state of union where they still maintain their individuality but can enjoy communion with God in the way that they want to. It's all a question of choice on a certain level. We have this concept of Ishta Devata, right? That we get to conceive of God in a manner that's most suited to us. So that amount of freedom is given. Now, this, of course, is an oversimplification. It's a stereotype, and all stereotypes can be, you know, misleading. But there is a certain kernel of truth, enough at least so that we can understand the hurdles that we have to get over in order to have a real harmony between these two different paths, because they do represent different personality types and different worldviews. Some people will say impossibility. Why even try? We simply have two different paths for two different types of people. Now, Swamiji says, it is not given to all of us to be harmonious in the building up of our character in this life. So for some, it may not be possible that we lean too much towards one or to the other. Yet, he says, we know that the character is of the noblest type in which all these three, that means the two wings and the tail, knowledge and love and yoga, are harmoniously fused. So a real integration of these different paths. So we know it's not possible for everyone. Some will have such a strong inclination towards one or the other that they'll follow that. But for most people, and this is, I think, a very wonderful development that we can really credit Sri Ramakrishna with initially, the best and the safest method is a combination of all of the different paths, all of the different yogas, specifically here, knowledge and devotion. And then meditation, of course. We need whatever path we follow, we need to spend that quiet time and that inward time. Now, what happened to karma yoga? You may be wondering, right? Well, there are only two wings and one tail, so we ran out of space. But we can say that without karma yoga, it means putting it into practice. So whether we're jnanis or whether we're devotees, we still have to be practical about it. And whatever sadhana, spiritual exercises we do, disciplines we do, that'll be our karma yoga. If it's disinterested, selfless action, we can be the jnani. If it's everything done as an offering to God, we can be the bhakta. So karma yoga will be split up, and it'll work with all of these. So what I'd like to try to do this morning is to explain what Swamiji means when he compares these two different paths, path of knowledge and the path of devotion, to the two wings of the bird, and to try to show how they can be harmonized and practiced together and how they help each other and balance each other out and help eliminate the disadvantages of practicing each one separately, which is a very important thing. Because practiced alone, there are certain dangers to each of the paths, to the path of knowledge and to the path of devotion. And from that point of view, this marriage of the two is a very helpful thing. Now, the other point is that after some type of realization, what Sri Ramakrishna calls coming back down from the roof, we find there's also a kind of natural marriage of these two paths, that after realizing our perfect oneness with God, when we come down, the little trace of ego is there, which allows a feeling of separation and a feeling of communion with God. So here again, we see this knowledge and devotion working together without any contradiction at all. Now, the more traditional point of view is that we do one or the other. Now, if we look at the early period of the Vedantic tradition, and by that I mean the Upanishadic period, the Vedic period, Upanishadic period, but mostly the Upanishads, we find that there's really not much scope for a highly devotional attitude. There's not much personal God there. Swamiji says we can find the germ of it. But really, the great emphasis is on the impersonal absolute and our oneness with that impersonal supreme Brahman. And there's a tremendous amount of grandeur and sublimity in the Upanishads with this idea that we are that and no need for any God outside of ourselves. Swamiji, of course, loved this very much. Now, what we don't have too much evidence about, but what is probably the likely scenario is that side by side with this Upanishadic tradition was also a devotional tradition, which is sometimes called as a Bhagavata tradition. The Upanishads were probably just reserved for a handful of specially qualified students. It wasn't the popular religion. The popular religion was probably much more like the Vaishnava tradition that we know about today. And they call it the Bhagavata tradition. It's not exactly our Bhagavata Purana. This is another very interesting thing. If you look at the dating of the Bhagavata Purana, the most important of all the Puranas for the devotional schools, the Indian tradition will say it's 5,000 years old, and Western scholars will say it was probably 1200 AD when it was composed. Yeah. Now, the fact is that the final composition tells us nothing about the origin of all the different stories and things. So it's quite likely that the gist of it is very, very ancient, as old as the Upanishads. All of the stories of Radha and Krishna as a young boy and everything, and that this was the predominant religion for the people who weren't great scholars, didn't know Sanskrit. It would be an oral tradition, of course, just handed down stories. And all of these together got put into one great scripture, which we call the Bhagavata Purana. So here we have really side by side a highly devotional tradition and a highly philosophical tradition with no overlap whatsoever. And as I say, this is what we come to see, that two separate margas, paths. There's Jnana Marga and this Bhakti Marga. Now, when we get to Gita, Bhagavad Gita, we start to see a little bit of a type of a harmony of all of the different yogas. But really, not so much a harmony as a belief that each and every one is possible to realize God through each and every one. So that each one is a legitimate path. Not so much that we're going to try to combine them. In fact, if we go to chapter 12, one of the most beautiful chapters on the path of devotion, bhakti yoga, it starts out with this question, which one of the two is better? So we see even Arjuna had this understanding, there are two separate paths. Those who worship the infinite impersonal Brahman and those who worship you, which means some personal idea of God. Now, Sri Krishna doesn't say that we'll really try to do them both together. He also doesn't say, well, there are two different types. He says, of course, there are two different types, but he gives a little preference to this bhakti yoga, to this devotional path, and we'll get to his reasons for that a little bit later. But so even in Gita, where we recognize the truth and the genuineness and authenticity of all the different paths, we don't have this harmonizing or this idea that we have to have both together equally, two birds, it has to be equal. Some later schools we find it, there's one place, conversation in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, where somebody says to Sri Ramakrishna that this is a new teaching that you're giving us, this harmony of knowledge and devotion. And he says, no, it's not new. And he points to the Adhyatma Ramayana and the Yoga Vasishta and other things. There were attempts earlier, but my feeling is that this is really one of the great special contributions of Sri Ramakrishna and through him, Swamiji also. He was very modest. He didn't like to say that he taught anything new. But every once in a while, he would come down from that high state and he would make statements like the experiences that have taken place here, meaning in himself, go beyond what's written in the Vedas and Vedanta. And we know some of his ideas about the Vijnana, the Jnana and Vijnana, what happens after God realization, how we come down and see the world differently. His idea about the different stages, the dualists, that we shouldn't take them as philosophical positions, but different attitudes to the change. So many things, and this combination of knowledge and devotion, which some have even given a name, this Jnana Mishra Bhakti, as a very special contribution. Now, how did Sri Ramakrishna, and of course later Swamiji, come to embrace this idea? Well, in Sri Ramakrishna's case, like everything else, it was his own personal experience. His spiritual practices, his realizations, all of it led to this. It's not that he sat down one day and tried to come up with a new theory and tried to work it out logically or anything. Everything with him was a direct realization. Because he started out in his spiritual life following various devotional paths, what we call dualistic paths, in some cases highly ritualistic paths. In the very beginning, as a priest in the Kali temple, he had to perform the highest type of ritualistic worship, which in almost all of the scriptures we read is the lowest form of spiritual practice. Not a bad form, but the kindergarten of spiritual life. Now, for some people, they can go directly from that to God realization. So and even Swamiji himself said, how can I look down upon ritualistic worship when the person I look upon as the master in my life realized God through it. So Sri Ramakrishna started out that way, with a highly dualistic type of and ritualistic type of worship. His spiritual practice, we say he spent long hours in meditation, but really that meditation was one of prayer and yearning and crying for Mother Kali, for a direct division. Who is this mother of the universe? Who was the real reality behind this image that I worshipped? He knew that the image itself was just a symbol. He wanted to know what that ultimate reality was. And it led to a state of great agony. We throw around this term, vyakulata, very, very lightly, that it means great longing for God. It doesn't mean great longing for God. It means tremendous agony at not having realized God. Of course, we want to develop this tremendous longing, this tremendous yearning for God realization, but it reaches the point in Sri Ramakrishna's life, it reaches the point where it's impossible to live another moment without it. And really, it means a type of spiritual anguish and agony. Anyhow, it was through that alone that Sri Ramakrishna had his first realization. But on many levels, it was an experience of oneness and non-duality, which we get from the path of knowledge. We don't know exactly what he experienced in that state. He said he was overwhelmed as if in an ocean, wave after wave of bliss, and he felt himself, and there's an ocean of consciousness and bliss. But when he came to normal consciousness, he was saying, Mother, 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 and some type of experience was there, so that generally we don't call it this Nirvikalpa Samadhi, which he had later when he practices Vedanta Sadhana under Totopuri. So it's a type of devotional oneness, we can say. A little mingling of this knowledge and devotion already we see there. And he practiced, of course, other dualistic modes of worship, all starting with the relationship. According to many of the Vaishnava teachings, the master-servant relationship, following the idea of Hanuman and all of the others that he went through. But each and every experience with him ended in oneness, that the object of worship would merge within him and he would lose consciousness. So more than just this feeling of union, this feeling of perfect oneness. So this was something a little bit out of the ordinary. Generally, those who follow a devotional path, they'll be more confirmed in their idea of the reality of the personal God. But for him, for Sri Ramakrishna, it all led to oneness. He said every spiritual path ends in oneness. Then finally, of course, he practiced directly his Advaita Vedanta, the non-dualism, when he was initiated by Totopuri. And after a few initial struggles, when the image of Mother Kali came to his mind, of course, he was able to merge his mind so deeply in that pure consciousness of the self that he remained in that state of samadhi for 3 days and three nights, and then later, of course, a long period, 6 months, where virtually the whole time he was lost in that state. But what was his realization afterwards? It was that the ecstatic love of God, which led him to his realizations in the beginning with Mother Kali and others, and the bliss of self-realization, which he achieved through this impersonal path of non-dualism, not only led to the same goal, but had the same source, this Satchidananda, this ultimate reality, which we call Brahman. His realization was that it's wrong to say that it's personal God alone or impersonal absolute alone, it's both. And this is a tremendous statement. We don't find this in other teachings, that this Brahman equally the infinite, absolute, transcendent reality beyond everything, and at the same time, a loving personal God that can be accessed that way. Now, a question may come, another question. If both wings are the same, and if this perfect combination of the two is also the best possible path, then why did Sri Ramakrishna do the same thing that Sri Krishna did by saying that, well, they're both wonderful, the path of devotion is a little bit easier. Why did he recommend it for most people? The reason can be found in the advantages and disadvantages of both. We always hear that path of devotion is a little bit easier, and we see that the obstacles on each are a little bit different also. Path of devotion is said to be a very natural, easy path. And when we say easy path, it's only relative to the path of knowledge. It's not an easy path at all. It's like every other spiritual path, it involves tremendous willpower and tremendous dedication and tremendous sincerity. It's not that we simply sit back one day and say, oh yes, I love God, and it's all over. It's that we have to put forth a little effort in the path of devotion also. But in any case, it's like if we want to climb a mountain and we don't have the capacity to go straight up, then we take a winding path. It takes a little longer, it's a little more gradual, but we won't have a heart attack on the way. We know that we have the stamina to do it if we have the patience. So rather than make that very steep ascent, path of knowledge is a very steep ascent, we can go gradually. Some of the other advantages are we get to make use of our emotions. We don't have to cast them aside. Our everyday relationships, we know what it means to love a mother, a father, a child, a husband, a wife. We know all of these things. So we can utilize that loving attitude, that feeling that we have towards actual people in our lives, and transfer that to God. So we get to utilize things rather than try to stifle them, which we have to do in the path of knowledge a little bit. So we are only asked to take these, give them a twist, give them a turn in a new direction, so we can be very positive that way. In the path of devotion, we don't have any special qualifications that we have to meet. We don't have to be very brilliant people. We don't have to have great knowledge of the scriptures. We simply have to have a desire. There's a longing for God or there's longing for devotion. So everyone is eligible that way. We just have to have that requisite desire to lead a good, pure, simple life and to try to develop this devotion. The other thing is that we can start out with our normal understanding of things. We can start out with a conception of God, which we may throw over later. We may think now that God is somewhere far off, in heaven somewhere, living in the clouds, sitting on a throne. We can have all of these ideas as a starting point. And as we deepen in our devotion and feel that distance and separation start to eliminate, we start to find God dwelling within, and we start to realize God is our very own self. So we don't have to have that perfect understanding at the very beginning. We keep changing and we keep deepening our understanding along this path of devotion. Now, what are the disadvantages of the path of devotion? As Bhakti Yoga Swamiji says, the one great advantage of bhakti is that it is the easiest and the most natural way to reach the great divine end in view. Okay, we know that. Its great disadvantage is that in its lower forms, it oftentimes degenerates into hideous fanaticism. Why? Because we think that our conception of God is the only one. We think that this is absolute truth. Others, if they don't understand it that way, then they're wrong. So this fanaticism can come if we don't have at least some higher knowledge underneath. The singleness of attachment to a loved object, without which no genuine love can grow, is very often also the cause of the denunciation of everything else. So this fanaticism leads to this whole idea of a jealous God who likes us better than the other people who will be on our side. All the weak and undeveloped minds in every religion or country have only one way of loving their ideal, namely by hating every other ideal. Herein is the explanation of why the same man who is so lovingly attached to his own ideal of God, so devoted to his own ideal of religion, becomes a howling fanatic as soon as he sees or hears anything of any other ideal. Then Swamiji goes on, a very nice thing. He compares the fanatic to a watchdog guarding its master's house. But he says only the watchdog is more intelligent than we are, because the watchdog can recognize its master in any guise that it comes in. We only recognize God if it looks he looks the way we want him to. Now, second disadvantage is the devotee may become so attached to rites and rituals, and especially our own rites and rituals, it has to be done our way, it has to be done in our language, whatever, that he fails to see the real purpose, confuses the means and the ends. Swamiji writes, or says, it is necessary to remember that forms and ceremonials, though absolutely necessary for the progressive soul, have no other value than taking us to that state in which we feel the most intense love to God. Okay, so these are the advantages and disadvantages of bhakti yoga. Now, path of knowledge, jnana yoga. It's direct. It's the most direct path. There's no compromise to truth. We don't start out with some false idea and with the feeling that, well, later on we'll correct it. We have to start out at the very beginning with this idea of perfect oneness. I am that. We start out with truth. We end with truth. There's no compromise. So there's a tremendous consistency. But it's difficult. The disadvantage is that we have this natural sense of identification with everything but the self. The self is the one thing we don't know. And yet we're trying to say, I am that. So it's very difficult. We have our attachments, all of these attachments, they weigh the mind down. This need to constantly discriminate between the real and the unreal. It takes constant vigilance to keep telling ourselves that we're the witness of everything, we're not this mind, we're not this body, that we're simply the onlooker, we're unattached, all of that. These are very difficult. And again, in chapter 12, Krishna's reply to Arjuna, he says, both paths of knowledge and devotion lead to the highest goal. The only difficulty is that for those embodied beings, or those who are very much attached to the body, so that means everybody, we all have our attachment to the body, that it's very difficult to follow this path. And the object of our meditation or of our search for God is so subtle. It's so subtle, this infinite absolute Brahman that we talk about. There's nothing to hold on to. The mind craves something concrete. At least there's some type of symbol. We sit for meditation. How do we meditate on that which is infinite, formless, which is beyond everything, transcendent? We can't do it. The mind needs something to hold on to. So on some level, the very subtle nature of the self, the subtle nature of Brahman, makes it extremely difficult for us to be able to fix the mind on it. So we try to meditate, and the mind wanders all over the place. It needs something to hold on to. Now, Sri Ramakrishna's solution to all of this is that, yes, we need this knowledge of Brahman, we need this knowledge of oneness, but he says that we take it, we stick it in our pocket. He says we tie it in the corner of our cloth because we understand that the mind is not capable of having that as the main spiritual attitude at all times. So keep it with you. Let that be always present deep down within. At the same time, develop some type of devotional attitude. Now, why develop an attitude in relationship? Because as long as we have this sense of ego, this I, it demands some type of relationship. If there's an I, there's a thou. And this is that basic I-thou relationship that we form with God. If we can get rid of this ego, there's no need for it. But it's so ingrained in each and every individual that we utilize it. This is his idea. It's a very practical type of idea. Now, what type of spiritual attitude do we have? How do we visualize this blending and harmony of this knowledge of oneness with this devotional attitude? Sri Ramakrishna gives us some beautiful illustrations. He says, think of this vast ocean and think of a stick lying on the ocean. Now, the nice thing about this illustration is that we know that a stick is incapable of separating one side from the other, and yet if we look from the top, we look down, it gives the appearance of separation. So this stick of the ego, he says, seems to divide this ocean. And because of that, we feel that there's one side to the left, one side to the right. We can feel that we were separate from all other individual souls and separate from God, or think that the whole ocean is God. But because of the stick of the ego, we can have a relationship, and at the same time we know that it's incapable of affecting the absolute oneness of the ocean. It can't separate one side from the other. It can only give the appearance of it. So we can follow this path until this ego becomes so light and so transparent, so ripe, that he says it's like a line drawn on the water. It doesn't even give the appearance anymore of separation. Then we can realize that perfect oneness. Then, second illustration, all of these have to do with water. Once he was asked, what is Brahman like? And normally he wouldn't say. Normally he would say, oh, it can't be uttered by the tongue what Brahman is like. But at one time he said, it's like water. And so we have a lot of illustrations with regard to water. We know this is another common one, that in very cold regions, the water can form into blocks of ice in different places. And he says that through the cooling power of the love of the devotee, the water can form into blocks of ice according to the desire of the heart of the devotee. If the devotee wants to see God in a certain form, this devotional nature can cause this infinite formless ocean to come into a particular form of God. So that personal God, and with the attributes and with the qualities that we like to see in God, or that we believe and hear in God, can be experienced that way. But he says when the sun of knowledge rises, then that water melts back into the ocean. But the point is that even when it's in a block of ice, it's the same water. There's no difference. So even throughout that devotional period, we can realize that this is just for our sake that really the ultimate truth is oneness. Then third illustration with water. We have this lake filled with water. This water is by nature formless. This is our infinite Brahman. It's formless. Now we want to access that. It does us no good if water's in the lake. Then we can't utilize it. We get a bucket. We get a pitcher, whatever it is. And through that, we take the water out. Now the bucket and the pitcher, they have a particular shape. So the water takes that shape. At the same time, the water is formless. The water has no shape of its own. The shape belongs to the bucket. So we have both, form and formlessness. The essential nature of Brahman doesn't change when we put it into the container of the mind. This is what we do if we want to access it. If we can do that, then we can use the water. We can bathe with it. We can drink the water. We can wash our clothes. We can do whatever we want with it. Otherwise, we sit on the bank and just say, oh, water is Brahman, water. We don't get to access it. We can dive in, of course. If we're real jnanis, we can do that. But otherwise, we want to access it. We have to give it a particular type of form. Now, what happens after the experience of God realization? What happens after even following a devotional path, we get to the highest point where we no longer see any distinction between God and ourselves. That ego completely disappears. We go into the state of oneness. Coming down from that, Sri Ramakrishna says, then we have two options. And each one, really there's not much difference at this point. Not much difference, but those who are devotional in nature, coming down means that a little bit of the ego is there, so a little sense of separation is there. We live in the world with a feeling of devotion, with an attitude of devotion. Or, he says, like Shankaracharya, we live in the world with this ego of knowledge. And even this ego of knowledge, this slight I is there. Even to say, I am Brahman, I'm one with the highest absolute, that is some sense of ego, some sense of I is there. But for the jnani, it's still living in this bliss of the Brahman. And for the devotee, also enjoying communion with the personal God. Very often, it's simply a question of which one appeals to us. I often refer to the Ram Prasad song that Sri Ramakrishna liked, where he says, I don't want to become sugar, I want to enjoy sugar. And this was Sri Ramakrishna's attitude when he came down from all of his experiences, samadhi and everything. He had to anchor the mind down to keep it from flying up all of the time. So his method was to enjoy the communion with God and the love of God and the company of devotees. So this was the way he could continue to live in the world. He said with bhakti and bhakta, with the company of devotees. So he loved to have the company of devotees, and he loved to engage in spiritual talk and devotional singing and dancing and all of these things. So this is what Sri Ramakrishna called the state of vijnana. The state of vijnana is one in which we see everything as divine, we see everything as pure consciousness, on the one hand, on the other hand, highly devotional state, where he says, in that state, we can talk to God, we can commune with God. So his direct experience was that after the highest realization, that there's... the highest type of spiritual truth to both the personal and the impersonal aspects of God. That there's no distinction at that point. So there we find in that state of realization, these two wings are perfectly balanced there. So we see that this path, which we can call Jnana Mishra Bhakti, we can say that devotion and knowledge commingled, working together, that they is a very beautiful way of taking us step by step to the state of oneness, where we eliminate all of the pitfalls of the path of devotion. We won't have that fanaticism if we know that our concept of God is simply our concept of God, and everyone else has an equal right to their concept of God. And our name for God is our name, because we like it, not because God has a name tag, and that's the only name you'll see on it. That everyone has an equal right to use a different name, so we avoid all of that. We establish a relationship with God because we have a sense of ego, that sense of I is there, and at the same time know that underneath that stick of ego is only oneness. But we follow this path, we go step by step. If we follow a very dualistic path, then we start out with this distinction between the worshiper and the object of worship, we reach a state of communion, we reach a state of union, and finally we reach that state where we can no longer talk about whether it's oneness with God or communion with God. I like this image of certain areas where the water in the bay mingles with the water of the ocean, say the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic Ocean. Sometimes the waters will go out and mingle and become one. Sometimes they'll come back and have a little sense of separation. We can say, yes, now this is the bay. And sometimes we say, no, now this is just the ocean water. And sometimes there's an in-between place where there's no way to distinguish one from the other, and yet it can go back and forth. This is very much that state in which Sri Ramakrishna lived. This is Bhava Mukha state that way. And where we can see... From one point of view, this dualistic model seems to work nicely, that this communion with God. From another point of view, perfect oneness, no distinction whatsoever. Both Sri Ramakrishna and Swamiji were beautiful examples of this combination of knowledge and devotion. And it's interesting that we associate Sri Ramakrishna with devotion and Swamiji with knowledge, and yet we hear the exact opposite, Swamiji himself, that Sri Ramakrishna was all devotion on the outside and all knowledge on the inside, but Swamiji himself was all devotion on the inside and all knowledge on the outside. However we understand that. But we see that in both of their lives, A beautiful blending. Swamiji was such a brilliant thinker. He had such a grasp of these subtle truths of Vedanta, and yet was such a fanatical worshiper of Divine Mother as well. And Sri Ramakrishna, no matter how much devotion he had to Divine Mother, still, the highest knowledge was always visible there. He always lived in that realm of perfect oneness. I want to close just by reading from the final paragraph of Swamiji's Bhakti Yoga. We all have to begin as dualists in the religion of love. God to us is a separate being, and we feel ourselves to be separate beings also. Love then comes in the middle, and man begins to approach God, and God also comes nearer and nearer to man. Man takes up all the various relationships of life, as father, as mother, as son, as friend, as master, as lover, and projects them on his ideal of love, on his God. To him, God exists as all these. And the last point of his progress is reached when he feels that he has become absolutely merged in the object of his worship. We all begin with love for ourselves, and the unfair claims of the little self makes even love selfish. At last, however, comes the full blaze of light in which this little self is seen to have become one with the infinite. Man himself is transfigured in the presence of this light of love, and he realizes at last the beautiful and inspiring truth that love, the lover, and the beloved are one.